Support for the World's podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. To learn about developments currently shaping markets, industries, and the global economy, subscribe to the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes and Stitcher.
The Butcher of Kabul gets a pardon, today on The World. I'm Jeb Sharp. Gulbuddin Hekmatyar is one of Afghanistan's bloodiest warlords. For many, his very name means blood.
And then the sound of rockets and the sound of bombs that he dropped on Kabul almost every day from 1992 to 1996.
Now Hekmatyar's been pardoned and invited to join the government in Kabul. Plus, a reporter living in Charlotte gives us her perspective on the protests there.
We are a part of the global conversation, really, on how police and law enforcement interact with their diverse communities.
And a potential swing vote in St. Louis, refugees from the Balkans.
Kosovars love Hillary Clinton.
Those stories are coming up here on The World. The government of Afghanistan today pardoned a man who is widely considered a war criminal, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. His name may not be familiar to most Americans, but Hekmatyar is one of Afghanistan's most controversial warlords, with a checkered history going back decades. For the past 15 years, he's been in alliance with the Taliban, fighting against the Afghan government and the United States. But he just got a full pardon from Kabul as part of a peace deal. We'll hear more about that in a few minutes. But first, we wanted to hear from an Afghan for whom all of this is personal. Qais Akbar Omar is the author of A Fort of Nine Towers, an Afghan family story. He's in Palo Alto, California. And I asked Qais what the name Gulbuddin Hekmatyar means to him. And I should warn you that some of his descriptions of violence are graphic.
His name means to me blood, dead bodies on the street, body parts, destruction of all the buildings in our neighborhood, and then the sound of rockets and the sound of bombs that he dropped on Kabul almost every day from 1992 to 1996. And whenever I hear his name, I start sweating. I get kind of warm, and it's like like heat rising all over my body, and it's a really horrible feeling because I remember all the days that we were trapped in the basement of our house with 50 or 55 members of my family. So this is how it worked with Gulbuddin Hekmatyar.
So we should remind our listeners that before the Taliban came to dominate Afghanistan, there was a prolonged civil war. Those factions who'd fought against the Soviets couldn't agree how to share power. What did that mean for Kabul?
It was in 1992 when civil war started, and he stationed himself in the south of Kabul. So he would announce a day before and say that I'm going to send 3,000 rockets to Kabul tomorrow. And we would be all trapped in our house and counting all the rockets landing all over the neighborhood. I remember one day that I counted like 280 or something. Then I stopped, and then my uncles and my cousins continued counting. So they reached up to like 800 or something. So when we had ceasefire a few days later and we went out, and all we could see was destruction, and dead bodies all over the place, body parts all over the roads, and blood, just all smeared all over the trees, walls, on the road, all dried up, and then dogs walking all around, sometimes even carrying body parts in their mouth, going from one house into another house. That's the kind of image that comes to mind.
Qais, how old were you when you were witnessing all of this?
I was 10. I was 10 when civil war started. And that lasted for 4.5 years. I actually talk about some of this in my book, A Fort of Nine Towers, because the reason I wrote even the book was more like a therapy to get all of
therapy.
To get all of these images out of my mind, because whenever I, up to 2007, whenever I watched news, I read something that was kind of graphic or related to casualties or people, you know, being injured in suicide bombing or rockets or anything. It just couldn't deal with it easily. So I had to seclude myself and go in a room and be away from everyone. And
did that help?
Actually, it did. It did help, but I'm one of the few people who managed to get himself a psychiatrist by writing get all of these issues out of my mind.
Yeah,
but I mean, I'm not the only one. There are millions. I mean, I can say it with ease that there are millions of Afghans who know Gulbuddin with that kind of image in mind. But at the same time, I understand or try to convince myself that I understand why the government of Afghanistan is trying to do this.
Why? Why? Because I want to understand that.
I think it's probably for a political reason, because the Afghan government has quite a few enemies, and having Gulbuddin Hikmatyar is maybe they are thinking is in the right direction to encourage the Taliban to come and be part of the government. But I would say highly unlikely that that's going to happen based on what we know of this man. And he always broke his promise so many times. He just read the news. If anyone wants to know about him, just read the news.
Yeah, the litany of alleged crimes is just incredible.
It's the longest. The list is so long that, you know, 1,000 pages, you know, one book, 1,000 pages will be probably too short.
Well, thank you for giving us your thoughts on this today. Qais Akbar Omar is the author of A Fort of Nine Towers, An Afghan Family Story. Thanks again.
Great talking to you, Jim.
Gulbuddin Hikmatyar also has a complicated history with the United States. He was the biggest recipient of aid from the CIA during the war against the Soviets in the 1980s. Later, he fought on the same side with Osama bin Laden. And since 2001, his fighters have been waging war against American forces from his base in Pakistan. In 2013, an attack by Hikmatyar's group killed 6 U.S. troops in Kabul. But now, as we mentioned earlier, he's a partner with the Afghan government. Dan DeLuce is chief national security correspondent for Foreign Policy magazine. He says Hikmatyar is a man of contradictions.
He was definitely very good at portraying himself as an important commander and fighter in Afghanistan in the 1980s. And then, of course, he was one of those warlords and commanders in the 1990s, after the Soviets left, that laid ruin to Afghanistan. And he and other warlords like him poured rockets and artillery shells on Kabul and left a trail of destruction. For the U.S. military, he is a villain. He's an enemy who is responsible, and his militants are responsible for a whole slew of attacks that wounded and killed many U.S. and NATO soldiers over the past decade and a half. But as someone who's relevant on the battlefield now, he's faded. His military power has receded. His insurgency is sort of spent. So he's sort of a figure from the past in some ways.
The obvious question then is why this deal now?
That's a good question. I think there are a couple answers to that. One source of speculation is that he's getting older, and some members of his family and inner circle were persuading him and lobbying him to enter into this deal with the Afghan government, that he could live in Kabul and sort of end an insurgency that wasn't really going anywhere. This was one path, and it would give him a certain prominence in his senior years there. So that's one thing. And then, of course, the Kabul government is anxious to try to somehow push for a peace settlement. And so if they can even take one group of fighters off the battlefield and cut a deal with them, it's to their advantage. And also, he exerts some influence among his followers, so he'll kind of be a political factor in the government's favor.
And he is promising to keep the peace and refrain from terrorism, however that's defined. But if he has one quality, he seems to be reliably treacherous. So how could he be trusted?
I think we'll have to see. I think we don't know. But it's also true that figures like him have cut deals over the years and did stick to those deals in some cases because it was in their own interest. But yes, you're right. It's perfectly possible that he could live to fight another day. But he had already sort of lost a lot of followers. So some of his fighters had gone over and shifted over to the Taliban there's a question as to how much impact he could really bring to the battlefield.
What has his relationship been to the Taliban?
He sees them as rivals. Yes, they have shared a common enemy in attacking NATO-led forces, but he is not willing to enter into a strong kind of alliance. And the Taliban, for their part, probably feel that they don't need him and they don't need his militants.
And the U.S., was the U.S. consulted on this decision to grant a pardon to Hekmatyar?
I'm sure they were. I'm sure they were very aware that this was going on, not necessarily opposed to it, but I don't think there are necessarily high expectations either in the Obama administration that this will somehow open the door to a golden moment of peace and reconciliation. The Taliban is still very much fighting and is gaining ground in many areas. The Taliban doesn't seem to be very interested in any kind of peace talks at the moment when they seem to be in a strong position on the battlefield. And of course, you know, the Obama administration's about to leave office. I don't think they wanted to get in the way of this, but I think the White House will be very skeptical as far as what can come of this in the longer run. But of course, throughout his presidency, Obama has tried to push for some kind of diplomatic political solution and couldn't really get anywhere.
Dan DeLuce, Chief National Security Correspondent for Foreign Policy Magazine, thank you.
Thank you.
And now to Iraq, where the Iraqi army is preparing a major offensive. The goal is to retake Mosul. Iraq's second largest city has been under ISIS control for more than 2 years, and life for people there has been difficult. One Mosul resident, we'll call him Ahmed, agreed to secretly record an audio diary for our colleagues at the BBC. Let's listen to some excerpts.
Hello. Today is Monday. Everyone here hope that the Iraqi army came and liberate them because the situations here began to worsen. About my escape, I hope to came out next days. Maybe there will be some elements of ISIS in the road. Then we will be in big trouble. So, good luck for me. Hi there. Today is Tuesday. This morning, my friend told me that he saw ISIS elements executed 3 people because they was talking about ISIS losses. I'm trying to keep careful and stay close to home. I feel like in a nightmare. Today is Wednesday. This morning was a lot of bombing near of our town. When I hear explosions, I'm concerned about my family and my friends. Today is Thursday. ISIS carried out an inception of some of houses. They're looking for mobile phones or other means of communication. They arrested a man in the street because they found a phone in his pocket. I too had taken several measures and hided my phone in a secret place. When they find you have a phone in your pocket, you are dead. Today is Friday. This morning I went to the mosque. ISIS tried to persuade people to join them, but no one cares. I wish to escape as soon as possible. I met with the smuggler a few days ago, and he told me when the way is safe, he will take me to safety. I hope in the coming days, that the way will be safe.
Ahmed is a resident of Mosul, Iraq, who recorded an audio diary for the BBC. And an update, after those recordings were made, Ahmed did manage to escape the city. You're listening to The World. The wars that led to the breakup of Yugoslavia in the 1990s created a huge refugee crisis. Tens of thousands of Bosnian Muslims came to the U.S., followed by a smaller number of refugees from Kosovo. Many of them were resettled in St. Louis. That was during Bill Clinton's presidency. Reporter Ryan Schisler says for years that community has been politically inactive, but that's starting to change. And he says there's talk of a Bosnian and Kosovar vote in St. Louis that might play a role in this presidential election.
I spoke to one Kosovar woman, Greta Marina. She's 22 and was resettled in St. Louis with her family in the early 2000s. But here's what she had to say about the election in the Kosovar community.
Kosovars love Hillary Clinton, all right? I mean, Bill Clinton basically welcomed us here with open arms. And she's his wife and so they're, I'm going to tell you they are obsessed with her.
That's wild, obsessed with her. And I assume that's right. About the gratitude that people in Kosovo feel towards Bill Clinton and therefore the Clintons. But what about the Bosnians? Are the feelings more complicated?
From the people I've talked to, the older Bosnians, the original refugees in the mid-1990s, really share that affinity with the Clintons. One woman I talked to talked about how older Bosnian women, you know, almost cry at the sight of him.
So what about Donald Trump? Is there any particular take on him in this community?
Yeah, those that I spoke to, both Bosnian and Kosovar, tend to feel ostracized by the Islamophobic anti-refugee rhetoric that they perceive as coming from his campaign because they are, of course, Muslim refugees of another era. And many people I spoke to say that when they see, you know, images of Aleppo, they see themselves 20 years ago. And that's something that Greta Marina spoke to as well.
We hear about the Syrian refugees and everything, and we hear Donald Trump's rhetoric, and it's unbelievable that in the year of 2016 we have to hear this stuff when 17 years ago it was, come on in, you know, welcome.
That's Greta Marina, and she's Kosovar. What about Bosnians in St. Louis?
Yeah, I talked to one man. His name is Ibro Tusakovic. He's an insurance agent now, originally from Sarajevo. I asked him how Bosnians, you know, how he notices them reacting to the anti-Muslim, anti-refugee rhetoric coming out of the Republican Party these days. And he said many of the older people in the community are frightened and skeptical because, in his words, they've seen what hate speech can do to a country and to a family and to a person from their own experiences during the breakup of Yugoslavia.
And there have been some images of Serbian nationalists showing support for Trump. I assume that feeds into that.
Right. The first instance of that that I came across was a photo from the Republican National Convention in Cleveland where a man wearing a Make Serbia Great Again hat was photographed in the crowd outside the convention. But more notably, in August, Miroslav Šešelj, the leader of the Serbian Radical Party, which is a far-right nationalist party, led a march in Belgrade to endorse Donald Trump, complete with T-shirts that said, "Vote for Donald Trump."
So this is pretty striking. You've got, you know, this community with old pain and a strong support for Hillary among Bosnians and some support for Trump among Serbian nationalists that is kind of triggering something for the Bosnians and the Kosovars. Just thinking about the election, how likely is it that this Bosnian-Kosovar vote, assuming they do vote generally as a bloc, could actually tilt Missouri Democrats?
Right. What it really will come down to is how close the election is in Missouri. In 2012, Mitt Romney won by more than 10%. If the Republicans have a lead like that this year, the community, you know, even if it voted as a bloc, probably couldn't make a difference. But if you look at 2008 between John McCain and Barack Obama, John McCain barely scraped by with a victory in Missouri. He won by fewer than 4,000 votes. If it comes down to be that close again and the Bosnian community is pushed for these various reasons to vote against Donald Trump or for Hillary Clinton, it could make a difference.
We'll be watching. Ryan Schisler is a reporter based in Chicago. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jeb.
It's hard not to think about identity when you think about Bosnia and Kosovo. They were both part of Yugoslavia before that country disintegrated along ethnic and religious lines. Mary Kay Magstad has been thinking about identity lately and how borders and immigration play into our concept of self. Mary Kay is the host of our podcast, Whose Century Is It?
The way that I approached it is talking to the head of the Department of Government at the London School of Economics, Chandran Kukatas. And he himself has a very interesting story to tell. He's a Tamil from Sri Lanka who grew up in Malaysia, went to high school in Australia, decided to stay and go to college and grad school there, became an Australian citizen, taught political theory in Utah, the University of Utah, now is in London. So he, as he says about himself, he's very pro-open border, very cosmopolitan in his way of thinking. He questions the whole idea of, you know, my country right or wrong. My country has to be defined by its ethnic identity. He says, you know, people have been moving around the world as long as there have been people. Borders have come and gone. And we really need to think about, as a society, if we consider ourselves to have a free society, to be an open society, we have to walk the talk. And that means thinking about who the we is and who we're leaving out and who we're allowing in. And just being a little bit more mindful about that process and not exclusive of entire groups.
Why do you think, given all of that, that we're so focused on ethnic and religious and other identities in an age precisely when many, many people are moving all over the globe at this kind of pace and scale.
One possible answer is that we've had a lot of wealth concentrated in the West for a very long time, and it certainly didn't bother Western countries one bit to go and violate other countries, other nations, other ethnic groups' borders and go into their land when, you know, it was the age of empire or when we were pushing west in the United States. But now we have something to protect and, you know, that's ours, and other people want to come and enjoy some of the same, you know, benefits and some of the same quality of life that we've long enjoyed. And we're like, whoa, you know, we've got this to ourselves. You know, we're 5% of the world's population, but we use 20% of its resources. And you've got a problem with that. And of course, other people do. And in an age of climate change and where there are these disparities, you know, regional disparities, and of course, disparities within our own society, of course, people who are on the losing side are going to push back and are going to try to get a better deal for themselves. You know, just philosophically speaking, what makes it okay for us but not okay for them?
And what does that question, in a way, tell us about the future of borders, which have so defined identity in the past?
You know, borders move. And it'll be an interesting trend to watch in this century, how much borders can be defended and how much a society is willing to pay to do that in blood, in treasure, but also in lost opportunities. You know, nothing ever remains the same forever. You know, things shift around. And so I think it's worth reminding oneself that this always has been part of human history and isn't likely to stop being part of human history as we move through the 21st century.
Mary Kay Magstad, host of our podcast, Whose Century Is It? Thank you, Mary Kay.
Thanks, Jeb.
You can find Mary Kay's podcast, Whose Century Is It? At pri.org/century and on iTunes. You're with the world.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Jeb Sharp. A North Carolina chicken farmer's been eyeing the Cuban market for a while now.
Some of the worst chicken I ever ate in my life was in Cuba when I went back in 98.
But will Cubans eat American chicken?
I expect that proximity and value would win out over ideology.
That story's ahead on The World. I'm Jeb Sharp, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It just keeps happening. More and more American cities are grappling with police shootings of African Americans and with the agony that follows, as the country as a whole grapples with the issue of racial bias in policing and as the world watches. Last night, there were more protests in Charlotte, North Carolina, where Keith Lamont Scott was fatally shot by police on Tuesday. Some of the protests were peaceful, others violent. The state's governor declared a state of emergency just before midnight last night. Mary C. Curtis is a longtime resident of Charlotte and a political columnist at Roll Call. I asked her what she thought the legions of reporters descending on her city from around the world needed to know about it.
They're this new South city that's diverse, majority-minority city. They're progressive, they're growing, and that when people see the images of downtown stores, or they call it uptown here, getting smashed, they want people to know that the evening started out with peaceful demonstrations, and that is Charlotte.
So there's a sense that people from outside could come with a stereotypical idea of an American city.
Yes, there is. But I think the Charlotte leaders have to also acknowledge that we are a part of the global conversation, really national and global, on how police and law enforcement interact with their diverse communities. And that is a real problem, as we've seen on videos and on stories really from all over the world.
And what did it mean to you that this happened in Charlotte?
I live in a part of Charlotte where they used to have restricted covenants in the deeds, and they are still in some, although they are not enforceable, that said they were only for people of the Caucasian race. So, of course, that's no more, but there's a legacy of that. So you can live in a very integrated city, but live in a segregated way and not really interact with people who are different. And there are some who feel perhaps left out of the Charlotte, you know, this new South progressive and very economically positive place. They feel left out of the jobs, education, the housing boom. And that's very real as well.
Those of us who maybe don't know Charlotte that well, we do know it's this major banking center and we know it's been booming. So how would you describe the winners and losers in that economic growth?
We have not just banking, health, tech. Those are the winners. The income and education level is pretty good, particularly considered we are so diverse. And I will say a lot of African Americans stood downtown yesterday silently to remind people that we aren't thugs and criminals, that we are doctors and lawyers and business people. But, you know, the jobs that don't pay as much, the retail and other working class kinds of jobs, really, it's difficult to make enough money to live in this new Charlotte. There was a study a few years ago that said that in the 50 largest cities, we were down number 50 when it came to social mobility. And as I mentioned before, too, there is an issue for a global audience that has a difficult time understanding the proliferation of guns. North Carolina is an open carry state like many others. So what do you do when you're policing? What do you think when you see someone with a gun? It could be legal. Who knows?
You know, we were talking about foreign reporters jetting in and descending on you all, and I imagine that they're pretty intrigued by North Carolina being an open carry state.
Yes, you have to have a permit to have a concealed carry. And the laws actually, with the conservative legislature, has been going to make this even a greater freedom to carry guns and have them in your car and all of that. So when police officers are approaching people, they have to, I think, a lot of times wonder if they are armed. Is that a gun I see? And then if you do see a gun, is this person up to a criminal activity or are they just having a gun as is their right? And I think that's where a lot of African Americans also have the question. You know, you have the Second Amendment right to have guns, but is it policed in the same way? Are people making assumptions?
And Mary, you must think about this in personal terms, too.
I do. I actually wrote a piece. It was my white husband loves guns. Our black son does not. And the subhead for me is I'm really fine with that. My white husband enjoys guns and owns a few, quite a few, and shoots skeet and other things. And our black son doesn't he's not really into the gun culture. My husband took him shooting when he was young and he wasn't really into it. And I have to say, I was happy that he decided that other hobbies were preferable to shooting and guns.
Mary C. Curtis is a political columnist at Roll Call. She's a longtime resident of Charlotte. Mary, it's so good to talk to you.
So good to talk with you, Jeb.
We stay in North Carolina for this next story. It's about farming and Cuba. In 2000, the U.S. economic embargo was loosened to allow American farmers to export to the island, and they did. The U.S. quickly became the largest food exporter to Cuba, but no longer. Exports to the island have fallen off a cliff, and many farmers argue the U.S. needs to fix that. Here's more from the world's Jason Margolis.
For more than 50 years, Cuba was an enemy of the United States. But not every American has seen Cuba as a threat.
You know, I tell folks all the time, I wake up every morning worried about something, but being invaded by Cuba is not one of them.
Larry Wooten is president of the North Carolina Farm Bureau. He's been leading groups of farmers to Cuba to look at ways to increase exports there. To him, it's a natural fit.
Here, we can ocean barge pork and poultry to Cuba. Some of the worst chicken I ever ate in my life was in Cuba when I went back in 98. When we were there last September, the food had improved.
His state can claim some credit for that. North Carolina exported $5 million worth of poultry products last year to Cuba. Now, Cuba hasn't come up much on the campaign trail in this presidential election, but a few days ago, Donald Trump did bring it up. He said he'd reverse concessions made by the Obama administration, such as easing of remittances and travel restrictions. Hillary Clinton has said, quote, the Cuba embargo needs to go. Larry Wooten says the Farm Bureau doesn't take sides in elections, but he will say that the U.S. should continue to ease restrictions on American tourism to the island.
Two things tourism need are good accommodations, hotels and places to stay, and good food.
His farmers can provide that.
This is eastern North Carolina in a little place called Chocowinity.
Sean Harding grows strawberries, tomatoes, sweet corn, soybeans, and wheat on his 150-acre farm. Harding considers himself a small farmer. He sells local, and Cuba really isn't on his radar. That said, he's a proponent of more international trade.
The more we export as a country, because we overproduce in the United States, the higher the price is going to be.
The more sweet corn that's sold to Cuba, the less there will be on the American market. So the price for his local corn would go up.
So it's a world market, no matter how small you think you are on this farm.
Overall in North Carolina, agriculture is a $13 billion industry. Cuban exports are just a tiny drop in that bucket, but they still matter, says Blake Brown, an agricultural economist at NC State University.
Well, it's a new market. The growth in product that they consume as their income grows will be very substantial. And it's right off our shore, so you'd be kind of crazy not to look at trying to move into that market.
But selling crops overseas is complex in the 21st century. Farmers need to help poorer nations finance their purchases. The U.S. Commerce Department often helps with that. But there are prohibitions against issuing American credit to Cuba. That's hurting North Carolina farmers.
So they had to be creative and find offshore financiers, maybe in Europe. I think Spain has been doing a lot of it.
Bottom line, though, it's easier for Cubans to do one-stop shopping, buy directly from another country, and finance the purchase there. The result, American farm exports to Cuba have steadily fallen over the past few years. The European Union, Brazil, and Argentina have eclipsed the U.S. Jennifer Harris at the Council on Foreign Relations says Cuba wants to buy American crops, even with the decades of mistrust between the two governments.
I expect that proximity and value would win out over ideology. And in fact, that's what you've seen by and large. I think the story of Cuba right now is one that is, you know, firmly heading in the direction of capitalism and respecting market physics.
Farmer Sean Harding says you never hear about American farm interests in Cuba from the presidential nominees. In fact, you don't hear much about farm interests at all.
Farmers are 2% of the population. We're a very, I think, important part of the population, but that's not a big voting block. And so I understand that both candidates are playing to where they can get votes. But it's disappointing, you know, that we don't hear more talk about our agriculture policy in this country.
Of course, getting back to exports and Cuba, American foreign policy toward the island is touchy and complex. North Carolina farmers get that. But they add, if Cubans don't buy food from them, they'll just get it from some other country. And they ask, how does that promote American interests? For The World, Jason Margolis, Chocowinity, North Carolina.
Okay, let's talk now about issues affecting a much larger portion of the U.S. electorate, women. This week, we're launching a campaign to talk about issues that impact all women, because so far in the primary debates, the candidates have been asked some 700 questions, but only 6 focused on women, according to one advocacy group. You might remember Hillary Clinton being asked about Bill Clinton's role as first spouse.
Probably still going to pick the flowers and the china for state dinners and stuff like that.
We want to encourage you to ask the candidates different questions about gender equality, for example, or policies that disproportionately affect women. You can pose your questions online using the hashtag AskAboutWomen. The first debate's on Monday, so come on, ask about women. Last month, an earthquake killed more than 290 people in central Italy and left several small towns in ruins. Thousands are still homeless. The focus is now on helping them and on rebuilding. At the same time, though, a unique rescue effort is underway to recover the history that's buried in the rubble, things like paintings and artifacts that date back centuries. Elisabetta Brunas is leading that effort. She's with Italy's Ministry of Culture. We reached her in Amatrice, one of the towns hit hardest by the quake.
In Amatrice, a lot of buildings came down, really came down. Churches, they have no roof anymore, and that's why we're working there and try just to rescue all the, let's say, historical artifacts that we can find, and all the paintings and all what means culture for us.
What is the task? What are you confronted with in Amatrice, and how will you approach it?
Well, the task we have, let's say the restorers, what we have to do is to rescue the artifacts. So that means that you have just to pack them, to find all the pieces together, and to try to save them, you know. Mainly, we found a lot of paintings. You have a lot of frescoes, so mural paintings, but at that time, we cannot rescue them at the moment. And what we are rescuing, what we are doing, we're working on oil paintings, paintings on canvas. You have even statues and processional crosses, altar, candlesticks, all what is part, you know, of a church, let's say.
Is this all in a warehouse somewhere? Are you cataloging it, or are you actually doing the restoration work?
No, we are not. We cannot do the restoration work. At the moment, we have to rescue them because we have a lot of objects, you know. So you have just to pick them, to rack them, to pack them, and to bring them to a deposit. And of course, the first thing is that you have firefighters. They take out from the church or from the building, which is not in good conditions. They take out all this stuff, all these objects, and make a picture of them. You make a small record of them, a very quick record, and you just wrap them in a correct way, of course, trying to find all the pieces together.
So you said firefighters. Are they specially trained firefighters?
Yes. Well, they know how to get into those buildings, you know, how to get inside and not to die. That's a problem because most of the buildings there, they have no roof anymore. And you have all the walls which are open, you see. It's really very dangerous. I can't get inside. I can't.
Do you train them how to handle the artwork?
We have to tell them what they have to pick up, you know, because we have an art historian with us, and the art historian just tells them what they have to pick up. Because, of course, you have a lot of things, you know, which are not, let's say, important from an historical point of view. And we have even the carabinieri with us, because they have to check, you know, that everything is there, and they have to notice, you know, at the end of the day what we have been taking, because otherwise things could disappear, let's say, unfortunately.
How old are these objects?
Well, the last day we took things from the 16th century, 16th, 18th century, or even before, you know. Some of them are from the 13th century. We just took church bells yesterday, and those church bells were from a church, let's say, dating from the 16th century.
What do you most want the public to understand about what you're doing?
Well, that those things, you know, are very important for the people there. Very, very important, because we have old people and people, you know, that was living there, because now those small towns are close to the people. They can't stay there. But they try to approach us and say, try to save this, I don't know, this saint or this, you know, this special Madonna or this special, because, you know, they just say they need them. You know, all those objects have a very special meaning for that people. Some people lost everything. So they only have, you know, those things that are part of their life. So some of them are simply lost. The aim is to try to recover the most we can.
Elisabetta Brunas is a conservation specialist with Italy's Ministry of Culture. She's in Amatrice, one of the towns left in ruins by last month's earthquake in central Italy. I'm Jeb Sharp, and this is The World. Between now and Election Day, we'll be talking to people outside the U.S. about how they see our presidential race. Amra Koura is an Egyptian entrepreneur who's been keeping a close eye on Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. We reached him at home in Cairo, and I asked him what stands out for him in the race.
What stands out is the difference between this election and any other election we've seen before. The two candidates are quite controversial in our point of view, at least from my point of view. And we have a very fragile state at the moment. It's barely holding together. So we do not require or need any more turbulence, really. The activists and the people who, you know, who are interested in the human rights, and they're very scared that if Trump wins, he will support Sisi more, and that will keep him in power. Why would you want to disrupt the status quo in Egypt? I don't understand it.
You support the status quo in Egypt and President Sisi. How do you see the U.S. presidency affecting what happens in Egypt, whoever gets in?
I have to be very clear about my support for the status quo, is because we suffered. We had chaos. There were like lines everywhere. It was a chaotic place. You couldn't go down at night. Now I'm living in a country where we're going to work normally, going to dinners, going to the beach. I'm enjoying this safety. You understand? I'm not very much enjoying the political side of it, but I'm enjoying the safety and the security I'm living in.
I understand.
So I don't want this to be disrupted. What the U.S. president in general would want is democracy in the Arab world. And it's obvious that the democracy that America, or its understanding of democracy, is totally different than what applies to us and what works in our country.
What do you mean by that?
In a country like Egypt, with 90 million, 50% of them are illiterate, it's impossible to govern a country. And this is what happened after the Arab Spring. We need a bit of autocracy and a bit of, let's say, a just dictator, because without that, it turns into chaos, unfortunately.
So would you say that inclination that you're describing is also part of the appeal of Donald Trump?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, with Hillary Clinton, it is the opposite. We actually are scared of what she might be doing in the Middle East. More disruption, adding more chaos to the area. The American support to revolutionary youth and stuff is great, fantastic in headlines. But when it comes to the ground, it's very dangerous. So it has to be governed in a different way than what the democracy system that's happening now across the world, or at least across the Western world. I'm not a great fan of Trump, to be honest, as a symbol of presidency. But I'm not also very favorable of Hillary Clinton because of her history with us, or at least with our country and our area.
Amra Koura is a producer, director, and entrepreneur. He lives in Cairo and travels widely around the Middle East. If you're interested in more conversations and stories about how a new generation is navigating the U.S. election, join us at pri.org/unconvention. You'll find more there from the world and from our partners, Mike.com and the 92nd Street Y. Finally today, we're so used to seeing images of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton on our screens and in our newspapers, and so are people in many other places around the world. A U.S. presidential election is big news, especially this time around. But if you were looking at religious newspapers in Israel, you might think there was only one candidate in the race. They never show photos of Hillary Clinton, and they probably won't, even if she's elected. Daniela Cheslow reports from the neighborhood of Bnei Brak near Tel Aviv.
I'm with Benny Rabinovich in his living room. He's a staff writer at the newspaper Yetedna Iman, and we're looking at an article about the U.S. elections.
Where's Clinton?
They didn't take Clinton. They took a picture of Trump. It's simpler. If you write about Clinton and Trump, it's much easier to run a picture of Trump.
Yetedna Iman's readers are ultra-Orthodox Jews, also known as Haredim, which means those who fear God. They represent about 11% of Israelis, and they follow strict rules of modesty. Unmarried men and women avoid touching each other, women wear long shirts and skirts, and sometimes married women wear wigs to cover their own hair. Benny quotes a verse of Psalms, "All the glory of the king's daughter is inwards," meaning women should cover up. Newspapers didn't exist in the time of Psalms, but strict rabbis in modern Israel have interpreted modesty as a ban on publishing photos of women and girls. There are four major daily papers here serving the ultra-Orthodox. A reporter at the oldest one, Hamodia, says back in the 70s, when Golda Meir was Israel's first female prime minister, they didn't run photos of her either. So what do you do when your religious readers want American election news and one of the main candidates is a woman?
There are a lot of approaches.
You can get creative with camera angles. In August, an ultra-Orthodox paper in the U.S. showed Clinton at a campaign event with her face blocked by the podium. Or you could just replace Hillary with Bill. That's what Yetedna Iman did when Clinton announced her running mate Tim Kaine. Benny says at the time, a correspondent for the secular Israeli paper Haaretz tweeted at him, "Hey, Yetedna Iman, what will you do if Clinton wins? 4 years of Bill?" Benny tweeted back,
"Bli Bill, im Bill, nistader."
Without Bill or with Bill, we'll manage.
But within the Haredi community, there is some mix of opinion. A few steps from Benny's house, I meet Tova Yosfan and her daughter. Tova is a full-time nurse and a mother of seven. She says maybe it's a stretch to put Bill Clinton's picture in the paper instead of Hillary's, but it's not terrible. And it doesn't make her feel bad or lessen her value as a woman if there are no photos of women in the newspapers, she says. At a wig store, I meet Dikla Cohen, who's helping a young couple pick out a wig. Dikla says newspapers have the right to choose what they publish. All the same, she says it wouldn't be so bad to show a picture of Hillary Clinton. It's not like the newspapers are publishing photos of half-naked models. And the daughter of a former chief rabbi of Israel told me she thinks the ban on Hillary's picture is unnecessary, but she wouldn't speak on tape about it. As for the editor of an American Orthodox magazine, he told me if Clinton is elected, he might change his policy and print her photo, if the rabbis allow it. He says he worries about alienating the U.S. government. Benny Rabinovich says his newspaper, Yated Ne'eman, isn't even considering it.
No, there has never been a picture of Hillary Clinton until today, and there never will be. Never. Look for it, and you won't find it.
For The World, Daniela Cheslow, Bnei Brak, Israel.
And you can see a picture of how one religious newspaper handled the Hillary photo dilemma. That's at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Jeb Sharp. We'll see you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.